Hi, everybody. Today is Friday, May 2nd, 2025, and our friends, Ambassador Chas Freeman and Professor Marandi, are back with us. Welcome back.
Glad to be with you.
Thank you.
Let's get started, Ambassador, with what has happened with the statement of the Secretary of Defense, the head of Pentagon. And here is what he said.
Pete Hegseth sending a very strong warning to Iran over its backing of the Houthi terrorists in Yemen. The defense secretary posting on X, "We see your lethal support to the Houthis. We know exactly what you're doing. You know very well what the U.S. military is capable of, and you were warned. You will pay the consequence at the time and place of our choosing." Managing director of Beacon Global Strategy.
Here is what he said, and your take, Ambassador.
Well, I think that's childish bravado, and I believe I've heard that Professor Marandi lampooned it, produced a parody of it, talking about the United States. I think this raises real questions in my mind about both the negotiating strategy that the Trump administration has with regard to Iran and the region generally, if there is a strategy at all. Second, how well what is going on in the negotiations between the Iranian foreign minister and Mr. Witkoff is coordinated with the actions of the Department of Defense. This is a statement that is unnecessarily threatening, and it reflects divisions, I think, in the administration. Which have been quite apparent from the beginning, between those who are what I would call America firsters, and those who are Israel firsters, people who adopt and embrace the Israeli agenda, which is essentially to reduce Iran to the status of Syria, that is, a country with no sovereignty, with no ability to resist Israeli military punishment. And a country with no military power to threaten Israel or sustain a balance in the region. I don't think that is the objective that is emerging from the discussions in Muscat and Rome, but we can't be sure what that is going to lead to because of the tensions within the administration and the unanswered question whether a return to the something like the 2015 Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA, is acceptable to the United States. It's clearly not acceptable to Israel. Or will the United States follow the Israeli line and demand Iranian disarmament and no enrichment program at all? We don't know. But this is hardly likely to help.
Yeah, Professor Marandi.
I really don't know. I don't comprehend what goes on in the White House and among those closely associated with Trump. Perhaps once upon a time, I would have said that they're playing good cop, bad cop. But I think that especially in this term, Trump's leadership is very chaotic, and his team is chaotic. It seems as if everyone says or is following his or her own policy. What I found strange also was that apparently the Witkoff retweeted the tweet of the Secretary of Defense, which is bizarre enough in itself. So what it really means, I think, for Iran is that we cannot trust the United States. There's no person in charge. There's no feeling of that there is stability in the White House, and that if there is some agreement somewhere down the road, that will be adhered to. And it's not just Iran. The Iranians are closely monitoring what's going on with Ukraine. We see different figures associated with Trump taking different positions. The representative to Ukraine is saying one thing, Witkoff is saying something else. And then ultimately, we hear that the United States is going to walk away. And it's also interesting that the United States behaves like as if it's the middleman, whereas it pushed Ukraine into this situation in the first place. And it's not as if Trump does say that it's Biden's war, but during his presidency, Trump continued to push for this escalation for 4 years. So Iran looks at that. Iran looks at the chaos surrounding the trade war, the tariff war, the different positions taken by senior officials, the retreat of Trump without the knowledge of people some people in charge of policy with regards to tariffs. When Iran looks, or when we see Gaza, that Trump, through Witkoff, engineers a ceasefire, then literally days later calls for ethnic cleansing in Palestine and supports the restart of the genocide. This sort of chaos does not indicate that there's some good cop, bad cop policy. It just indicates that there's chaos. And that makes it, I think, almost impossible for the Iranians to negotiate a deal with the United States. And the fact is that the Iranians are not going to accept another JCPOA. If there's going to be a deal, the Iranians will want a deal where the Americans cannot just simply ignore it or tear it apart or walk away from it. There will have to be some means to protect the deal where the United States will pay a political price or a price for violating the deal. I think the model that we saw 3 years ago will be perhaps more acceptable to Iran than the JCPOA. And the model 3 years ago also needs to be updated because Iran's technological advances have to be taken into account. The United States has sanctioned Iran all this time. If the Americans are going to compensate for the sanctions that they've imposed on Iran, that's one thing. But if they don't, then the Iranians want to preserve their achievements. So when you take that into consideration, the fact that the Iranians are not going to, not only are they not going to mothball their nuclear program, they're not going to accept going back to what existed years ago. And then on the other side of the table, you see this utter chaos. I don't see any reason to be very optimistic about a deal.
Ambassador, with the case of chaos, we can consider the firing of Mike Waltz being part of that picture. And we know that Mike Waltz was so much in favor of, he supported Israel. But do you think that if Marco Rubio assumes the position of Mike Waltz, that would bring some sort of change, or we're going to see the same sort of manner?
Well, I think the word chaos is a good word for this situation. Mr. Waltz has not effectively coordinated any kind of policy process within the U.S. government, in part because the commander-in-chief, the president, insists on making all the decisions and does so on a completely haphazard basis without any support from staff. He seems to listen to the last person who spoke to him and to act on that opinion. So I don't know that Mr. Waltz's departure, which apparently was instigated by a right-wing Zionist activist, Laura Loomer, he accused him of being disloyal to Trump or critical of Trump. I think critical rather than disloyal is the right word. And she brought forth apparently some visual evidence, documentary evidence of his having criticized Mr. Trump in an earlier period. And for that crime, mainly, he was dismissed. Of course, there was also the Signal telephone conversation, and it's pretty clear that he did not divorce Signal. He continued to use it. There are photographs from the cabinet room in the White House showing him using Signal, and in fact using an Israeli program to download and record his files on the telephone. So there were lots of reasons, political and otherwise, to get rid of him. I think going back to the subject of U.S.-Iranian talks, I'd make a number of comments. Let me just say, Marco Rubio is an outsider who is trying to become an insider. As Secretary of State, he has been marginalized by Steve Witkoff. It's not clear how much he knows how to operate a policy process within the U.S. government, or whether Mr. Trump even wants one. So I'm not sure what difference this really makes. It is true that Mr. Waltz was a hardliner, and very much a member of Israel First within the administration. Mr. Rubio seems to be the same. So I don't think you can read too much into this from that. But having said that, we have the problem that Mr. Netanyahu's position, which seems to have great influence over the president, is that a Libyan solution should be applied to Iran. That means Americans go in and physically destroy everything in Iran, inspect it, and basically run Iran for a while in order to implement whatever disarmament agreement has been reached. There's no way, in my view, I'm ready to be corrected, but I don't believe there's any way any Iranian nationalist could ever accept such an outcome and such a humiliation for a proud nation. So I think this is essentially a non-starter. And we're left with the problem that we have six B-2s sitting in Diego Garcia with appropriate tanker support for escorts and for the bombers themselves aimed at Iran. Of course, what I'm hearing now is, and this is very relevant, that Iranian preparations for an attack have been so thorough and effective that only nuclear weapons could destroy them. And so this leads automatically, both in Israel and in the United States, to discussion of a nuclear attack. Horrendous as that would be. Here, I think the United States retains a fair amount of the traditional nuclear allergy. The understanding that crossing the threshold into a second American use of nuclear weapons against an adversary would be a step too far and would unlock Pandora's box and lead to the vast proliferation of nuclear weapons globally. I'm not sure that Israel shares any of that caution. I think we're at a moment that we've all recognized is very dangerous, but perhaps we haven't recognized quite how dangerous it is. And we have to hope that sanity, reason prevail. And I have to say, in Washington, that will not be an easy thing to happen at the moment. There are too many divisions. It's too much, to use Mohammed Morandi's word, chaos, to be able to predict what will happen.
Yeah. Professor Morandi, Marco Rubio demands Iran walk away from uranium enrichment and long-range missiles. When it comes to Ukraine, we know that what Russia wants. They said these are the red lines on the part of Russians. What are the red lines on the part of Iranians?
Iranians have said it repeatedly that they will not negotiate their allies in the region. They will not negotiate their conventional military capability, and they won't negotiate their right to have a peaceful nuclear program. And I don't see any chance of that changing. We have to remember that during the Trump years, when he tore up the deal and reimposed maximum pressure sanctions, because the maximum pressure sanctions began with Obama when he targeted ordinary Iranians through those sanctions, Trump revived those sanctions, strengthened them. I think Obama called them brutal sanctions, and Trump called them crippling sanctions, or vice versa. But in any case, the objective was to brutalize the Iranian population, to cripple the Iranian population. But Trump didn't get his way. The Iranians never submitted their sovereignty. They did not accept a new deal imposed by Trump under those circumstances that he imposed. And today the situation is very different from the Trump years that we had during his first presidency. China's on the rise. It's much stronger today than it was before. It is much more, it's much more angry towards the United States because of the trade war. I'd be cautious in front of Chaz to speak about the Chinese with his vast experience, but I just returned from China this morning. The Chinese have changed significantly. The Chinese always, their policy changes very slowly. They are very slow to change. But what we've seen over the past 100 days or so since the policy in Washington changed towards China, in my opinion, is a quite radical shift. And that benefits Iran-Chinese relations. So China is stronger today, relatively speaking, than 7-8 years ago. Its relationship with Iran is improving rapidly, similar to how the Iran-Russia relationship improved over the war in Ukraine. The Iran-China relationship is improving as well. And then we see that Iran's relations across the global south, or the global majority, they've also evolved and improved. But in the Persian Gulf region, you see a sea change in mentality. The son of the Saudi king has come to Iran, the minister of defense, seeking better ties. This is the same Saudi Arabia that a decade ago was seeking war. And of course, the Emiratis and others were seeking war as well. But today they know that Iran's conventional capabilities are so much greater than what existed in the past, that any war would lead to, I believe, the destruction of all of the regimes in the Persian Gulf region. So they want better ties. Russia and China have much better ties. The United States has its plate full with trade war and war in Ukraine and internal problems. So I don't see any reason why the Iranians would become any softer at the negotiating table than before. In fact, I think it will be the opposite. The Iranians will be tougher, not irrational. I think the Iranians are more than willing to have a deal, but a deal that respects Iran's sovereignty. I don't see that happening. Trump doesn't have the tools, ultimately, that he had before. We saw yesterday on Truth Social, he spoke about secondary sanctions and how any country that does deals with Iran with regards to the oil and petrochemical industry, they will be sanctioned. It's not going to change Iran's export. I think it won't have any significant impact on Iranian oil or petrochemical exports. And that, I think, is one of a sign of the change. 7-8 years ago, Trump was able to prevent Iran from exporting, but now Iran's partners are going to ignore Trump. China is not going to behave like it did 7-8 years ago, for example.
If I may comment, Nima, on a number of issues. implicit in Professor Mirandi's comments. The first is, I think the use of the word deal is misleading. We don't need a deal, which is a transaction. We need an agreement. We need an agreement that will provide a lasting basis for coexistence. Hopefully cooperation, but if not that, at least peaceful coexistence. And here, I'd note that it's not just the world that has changed in the United States and the Chinese. I agree with Professor Mirandi, the Chinese are in a completely intransigent mood. They are not going to sacrifice their dignity for the sake of an agreement with the United States when they see the United States as having a policy toward China very parallel to the one that we followed toward Iran, namely aimed at regime change and weakening and isolating them, which they will not accept. And they have the power now, economically and otherwise, to prevail in a trade war, and they see that. So they are going to wait this out. They won't stop talking because they are intelligent diplomatically, and you should always maintain a dialogue. So we see now hints of some sort of effort to deal with the fentanyl issue, if the Americans could define what the Chinese have to do that they haven't done already. I mean, the fact is that the United States has 5% or less of the world's population, but accounts for 80% of the world's opioid consumption. From the Chinese perspective, this is all a very ironic reversal of the situation in the Opium War, when China was weakened by drug addiction through foreign interference. Anyway, I won't go on about that, but let me make a couple of other comments that are about changes. When the Islamic Republic was born, there was a stereotype of it. I won't argue that it was correct, but it was certainly there that it was a country of religious fanatics bent on regional hegemony. That was the stereotype that was imposed by, and it led to the formation of the Gulf Cooperation Council across the other side of the Persian Gulf. But now the country that is religiously fanatic, territorially expansive, and interested in hegemony is Israel, not Iran. And Iran, for whatever reason, is much less ambitious than it was, and Israel is more ambitious. And so this creates a security issue for everybody in the Persian Gulf. And it raises a question that I've pondered, and I'd welcome Professor Mirandi's thoughts on this. When we had a division of Europe in the Cold War and a danger of nuclear exchanges and great havoc, we came up with the Conference on Security and Cooperation in Europe. And this essentially brought together on the basis of basically a religious basis, the basis of ethical traditions in both Roman Catholic, Western theology, and Russian Orthodox theology. We found enough common points of agreement between these traditions to create a dialogue and a process that basically led in the end to the end of the Cold War and the beginning of something new. Now, we may not have dealt with that very effectively, but it was a major opportunity. And I have always wondered why, given, you know, as an outsider, not a Muslim, I look at Shia and Sunni Islam, and I see many points in common. Where are the statesmen on the two sides of the Persian Gulf who can reach across it to identify those points in common and build a cooperative organization, a dialogue, a system for dealing with the security and other issues, economic issues, development issues in the region? We have institutions like the Organization of the Islamic Conference. We have the Islamic Development Program based in Jeddah. We have We have institutions within Islam that are bridges between the two traditions, major traditions. Of course, there are others as well. And the Alawites are not doing so well at the moment in Syria as a result. But where is the sense in Tehran, in Riyadh, in Doha, in Abu Dhabi, to explore what could be done to basically achieve independence from global geopolitics for the region, because that's what this would mean. It would mean taking the future into the hands of the people in the region on the basis of agreed principles. So I pose this, it's probably an odd moment to raise this question when we're confronting the danger of a disastrous war in the region, but maybe that is a good time to pull up short and ask, what sorts of alternatives to this are there? In other words, if you can't have any help from the great powers outside the region, what can you do inside it among yourselves?
Professor Marandi, I think we can bring Azerbaijan to the picture because we had President Pezeshkian's visit to Azerbaijan. He mentioned the same point that Ambassador was talking about.
Yes, I think that that's really what the Iranians have tried to do on numerous occasions. I recall after the Iran-Iraq war, although the Saudis were deeply involved in the war, the Saudis, the Kuwaitis, they were funding Saddam Hussein's army, and they were providing intelligence, the Saudis in particular, through the AWACS planes that were provided by the United States to gather intelligence against Iran and for the sake of Saddam Hussein. But when the war came to an end, and subsequently Saddam went and invaded Kuwait, the Iranians gave refuge to Kuwaitis, and Iran was open to rapprochement, the relationship between Iran and Saudi Arabia was rebuilt, and when the Islamic conference was held in Tehran, the crown prince at that time and subsequent King Abdullah, he attended, and he had private conversations with the leader and Mr. Rafsanjani and also the president at that time. I think the real problem has been foreign manipulation, and meaning the United States in particular, and how they've always tried to divide the region. Even though when Iran had enormous problems with Qatar, when the Saudis and the Emiratis imposed a siege on Qatar, the Iranians basically saved the country by keeping their airspace open, by facilitating trade. Iran could have done a deal to bring down the regime, and probably they could have taken a piece of the cake. And there are some in Iran who still say that Iran made a mistake back then. I think that that would have been an unprincipled position to take. And even though Qatar has done Iran great harm and the region great harm, and it's really the driving force between ISIS and Al-Qaeda. It has been since 2011. But I think that Iran's position was a moral position in that regard. And also, as I'm sure Chaz knows, when General Soleimani was murdered, he was on his way to see the Iraqi prime minister. The Saudis had sent a message to him in the context of rapprochement in order to bring about some sort of rapprochement. I don't know who began the discussion, possibly the Iraqi prime minister, possibly General Soleimani, but he was going there to speak to the prime minister. The prime minister at that time told me personally, Dr. Adel Abdul Mahdi, that he was going to have breakfast with General Soleimani to have this discussion. And I'm sure that the Americans and the Israelis knew that. So they have people all over Baghdad. And that's probably one reason why they murdered him that night. So I think that I don't see any reason why what Chaz is saying is not possible. I think that that is something that the Iranians and the Saudis and others would pursue. And ironically, I think that the Chinese played a very constructive role in helping build another bridge or rebuild the bridge between Iran and Saudi Arabia, whereas the Americans have been trying to, and the Europeans, they've been trying to destroy any bridges that exist between Iran and its neighbors in the Persian Gulf region. I agree completely. One reason why the Saudis are concerned is the behavior of the Israeli regime right now. And that also draws them towards Iran. But I think there's also another force, and that is, or a lack of force, and that is the weakness coming that they see in Washington, the weakness that they see in the West, and they want to sort of hedge their bets, as they say. They want to broaden their relationships, not just with China and Russia, but also with Iran. I still believe that the countries in the Persian Gulf, the Arab family regimes in the Persian Gulf, that they are still Western oriented. After all, that's where their money is. That's where they go for vacation. That's where they send their people for education. But I think that they are beginning to see that the West is not enough, that this so-called U.S. umbrella, protective umbrella, which is not really a protective, but I think it's there to keep them under control. I think they feel that the United States doesn't have that sort of authority anymore. So that does provide an opportunity for real dialogue, for rapprochement. And I don't think it's just about when Iran can have, I mean, 40 years ago, when I was young, Iranian antagonism towards the Soviet Union was identical to almost towards, as to compared to its views of the United States. But after the collapse of the Soviet Union, we saw fundamental change in the way in which the Russians behave towards Iran. And now we see that the relationship between Iran and Russia are definitely better than they've ever been before in history. Russia is Orthodox. Iran is Muslim. It's Shia. Iran and China. The relationship between Iran and China today is, as we speak, is better than it's been. I can't say for certain, but I think it's probably more important, at least, than it's ever been for the last few hundred years. China is not Muslim, but that's not the problem. The problem for Iran has been that the United States has a hatred towards Iran, which is deeply linked with the U.S. relationship with Israel. And it's something that I think, at least for the time being, is not nothing, not much can be done about this animosity.
Yeah. Ambassador, when Sergei Lavrov was here in Brazil, he had an interview with Global News in which he mentioned that Russia is willing to improve its relationship with the United States, but not at the expense of its allies. I would assume he's talking about Iran and China. And this,
I'm not sure who he's talking about, but that is a standard diplomatic principle. I was part of the opening to China with President Nixon. If you go back and look at the Shanghai communique, which resulted from that visit, you will find that the first 5 pages are a very blunt definition of the differences between us with respect to our various client states and allies or partners. So we had to have a discussion about North versus South Korea, North Vietnam versus South Vietnam, Indochina, the Kashmir issue, and other things, in order to, and we had to make it public that we had that discussion in order to reassure our respective friends, China's friends in Hanoi, ours in Saigon, that we were not selling them out. So I think that's what Mr. Lavrov is saying, that he's the same principle that Professor Mirandi described as applying to Iranian foreign policy, namely that Iran will not negotiate on behalf of the resistance movements it supports, because it values those for a variety of reasons. So I think that's pretty clear. So I will stop here, but I do think it is interesting that national interests can transcend religious differences, whether they're with Russian Orthodoxy and Iranian Walayat al-Faqih, or whether they are between China and Iran, because, and here I will confess that I had something to do with introducing China to Iran as part of the Cold War effort to isolate the Soviet Union. So I'm very familiar with that dynamic. And I will shock the two Muslim people I'm speaking with when I tell you what Confucius replied to his disciples when they asked him whether there was a God in an afterlife. And he said, well, those are very good questions. He said, there's so much for me to do right now down here, I haven't had time to think about them. So this is the Chinese mentality, which is very pragmatic. If you go to a Buddhist, a Lama temple in China and see people burning incense and worshiping idols, and you ask them whether they believe in it, they'll say, not really, but what if it's true? I'm just taking out an insurance policy. So these are people who think very pragmatically. But to come back to the Persian Gulf, it does seem to me that it should be possible to build something not only on shared national interests now threatened by the predations of Israel, and I in fact see evidence that that is happening, that is driving people across the Persian Gulf to explore each other. Professor Mirandi mentioned Khalid bin Salman's visit to Tehran. That is a sign of this. But I think there also is, there is a missing piece, which is an effort to find reconciliation through common religious principles. I don't think that's impossible. And here I will just say, Professor Mirandi mentioned the late King Abdullah, who was a very good friend of mine. I used to go see him when I was ambassador. On one occasion, the spring of 1992, I was instructed to go brief him on the Iranian nuclear program, which I was told was just 2 years away from producing a bomb. I went and talked to the Crown Prince then, and he said then, as he said later, look, you're one of the few people who even pays attention to me, because the king doesn't consult me on anything. I enjoyed my conversations with him. He was a wise man. But he was rabidly anti-Persian. He basically foamed at the mouth when you mentioned anything about Shia or Persian traditions or presence. And yet, when he became the regent, not the king, the first thing he did was to reach out to Rafsanjani. He saw this, and I asked him about it in a private meeting. I said, why, this is a surprise given the way you seem to feel about Iran. And he said, now I'm in charge, I must act in the interest of the nation. And he did that. And he also opened the National Dialogue on Religious Matters. And he endowed an institution in Vienna for trans-religious dialogue. So this man who was self-educated, very, very devout in his religious beliefs, had a degree of open-mindedness and sense of statecraft that allowed him to transcend his own prejudices. And this, I think, is what we need. And here, I would also say, in closing, something about the current king of Saudi Arabia, who is marginalized, of course, by his son, the crown prince, because of his health. But when I first met him, he told me he had been given two pieces of advice, right, by his brother Fahd, then the king. Fahd told him, "You must do two things to prepare if you become king. You must learn English," he said. Well, Salman tried very hard to do that, but he had no ability at languages at all, and so he failed. And the second thing he said is, "You must study the lore, the history of Islamic statecraft." And Salman hired tutors to learn that. And I watched him over the course of more than a decade climb a ladder of knowledge. And so when I would ask him about something going on in Iraq, this is long after I ceased to be ambassador, but I would just go to see him because I enjoyed talking to him and hearing him. He would say, "Well, this reminds me of something in Al-Andalus. This emirate and that emirate had a quarrel and they did this and it didn't work, but it might work in this case." So this is the man who drew on that body of common historical knowledge and applied it intelligently. And I find it difficult to believe that a nation run by a theocracy does not have similar depths of knowledge about Islamic statecraft, as well as the Shahnameh and other sources of Iranian tradition, which are very rich. You should read Firuz, I guess, but anyway. So I think something is possible. And the fact that the United States is marginalizing itself is an invitation for people in the region to seize the initiative. If Professor Mirani is right about why Soleimani was murdered, and I think he may well be right about that, this is an opportunity for those who prefer peace to war and who prefer cooperation to antagonism to see what they can do.
Yeah. Professor Mirani, one of the signs that the region needs to think about what's going on within the region is the situation in Syria. We know what has happened and the new government in Syria, even having HTC and Daesh, Al-Qaeda in Syria is not that much satisfactory for Israel. And Israel has attacked Damascus as yesterday. And do you think that what is happening right now in Syria and the way that we know that they're trying to put pressure on Lebanon as well, if they attack Syria, which is trying to do everything to say to Israel, "We are not going to attack you. We are not going to have anything to do with you." And they're trying to put pressure on government in Lebanon in order to disarm Hezbollah while Israel is attacking Lebanon. How do you see the situation in Syria and what is the connection? What can we learn for the case of Lebanon?
Well, just one thing I'd like to add to what Chaz said is, I think, which is significant. When Khalid bin Salman came to Tehran, the Saudi defense minister, he met the leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, and he told the Saudi defense minister that years before Crown Prince Abdullah, who was effectively the king at that time, when he was here, I said, I paraphrase, I don't remember the exact words, but he was saying that we will go as far as you want in developing relations. In other words, if you want to have better relations, we will go as far, we can go as far as you wish. But I think what happened later on in Saudi Arabia and so on prevented that from happening. But he also, when he spoke to the Saudi defense minister, he said something very interesting, and that was that we are willing to provide our technological experiences or our advances to Saudi Arabia. And many in Iran interpret that as meaning that we are willing to help Saudi Arabia with its nuclear program, meaning and nuclear enrichment in particular. And I think that is a very, very significant gesture. Now, I doubt that the Saudis would take that offer for a host of different reasons, but if they wanted, I'm sure the Iranians would do that for them. So the Iranians are very serious about the relationship, even though, as I said, historically speaking, they were with Saddam Hussein, then they spread Wahhabism. Later on, to a large degree, and sadly, Turkey and Qatar took over this Salafism and support for Salafism. And we saw just a few days ago, I don't know if I'm sure both of you have seen the interview of the Pakistani defense minister on Sky News, where he said, we did the dirty work for Western intelligence agencies for decades. I'm worried that I believe perhaps in the years to come, some Turkish foreign minister will be saying the same thing, and how the destruction that we've seen in Syria is really thanks to Mr. Erdogan and Qatar to a large degree. So I think the possibility for rapprochement is there. I think we may be moving in that direction. As things stand, the relationship with Saudi Arabia today is much better. With regards to Syria is a catastrophe, and I think the Israeli regime, what they're trying to do right now is to through the stupidity of Jolani, and perhaps this is intentional, people behind with Jolani, or perhaps Turkish intelligence are pushing things in this direction intentionally, I don't know. But what Jolani is doing is he's giving the Israeli regime an excuse to create a division in Syria between the Druze and the government. And the Israelis have already occupied huge parts of Syria after the fall of the former president Assad. The areas that the Israelis have taken, I've been to many of these areas, they are the most important areas in the country. And I think maybe 30 to 40% of the country's water comes from those areas, the heights, the snow, the water. It's key for the survival of Damascus, and for that Damascus to be a meaningful city. It's key for Syria to have control of these areas, and the Israelis have taken all of them. And now, through the stupidity of Jolani's forces, the Al-Qaeda or Al-Qaeda and ISIS forces and the other groups, they are pushing the Druze towards Israel, which I think is intentional. Someone, the Israelis, others are behind this because they want Syria to be broken. They want to balkanize Syria. Now, this is—it's not that easy, because this is not an easy solution that necessarily is all beneficial for the Israeli regime. For example, in Lebanon, the Druze leader he sees Jolani's actions, and that pushes him closer towards Hezbollah. Or, for example, you see how the Lebanese government is trying to dismantle Hamas and Islamic Jihad's military capabilities, and that is something that the Sunni community in Lebanon is taking note of. Or Jolani's antagonism towards the Palestinians and the recent arrests of Islamic Jihad members in Syria. This is changing the narrative in Syria and among many who before, for whatever reason, either sided with Jolani and the Turks and the Qataris and the Americans in this regime change operation or Operation Timber Sycamore. It is changing the narrative. It is changing how they perceive this, the events of the last 10, 15 years. And that actually, and I've seen anecdotal evidence of this, that has actually strengthened the status and stature of the resistance, because many are saying that what Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah was concerned about with regards to the takeover of Syria by these extremist groups, it turned out to be correct. Many people who I know in Lebanon who were more critical of the position taken by the resistance in Syria today, people who I know, I'm not saying everyone is like that, but people who I know are today, they have very different views of what has happened in Syria than they'd had a year ago or 6 months ago or 4 or 5 months ago. So it's very complicated, but my biggest concern right now is that they are pushing Syria towards a fragmentation. And this, of course, is not something that's good for Jolani either, because Jolani, when he focused on the Alawites and when he carried out genocidal attacks, or at least when he allowed genocidal attacks to take place alongside the coast, some people tried to, apologists said that this was because of Assad or because of the previous regime. But now that he's directed his focus on the Druze, and also there's talk, there's a lot of the rhetoric about the Kurds is very similar as well. I think that is making Jolani's support base smaller and smaller. I don't think he's going to last. I don't think the regime will last. But Syria is in a very, very dark place, and it's unclear where it's going to go. But right now, actually, the resistance is not being harmed by this. Syria is being harmed, and it is tragic. But Hezbollah's stature is actually enhanced when its antagonists are exposed in this way. And the Israeli regime, while it benefits from this Balkanization, as I said, in some respects, but it is overstretched. And its presence in Syria, alongside its continued presence on the Lebanese border, it's the genocide in Gaza, the intensification of ethnic cleansing in the West Bank, and the periodical missiles that come from Yemen, that are fired at Tel Aviv and other places. This is alongside the deep divisions that we see inside Israel, which I think are probably the most important thing of all that are least discussed in different circles. I think these actually show that the Israelis are in a very difficult position. I think one reason, or maybe the main reason, why the Israelis or Netanyahu is so keen on an attack against Iran by the Americans is because the situation in Israel is so bad, and his situation is so bad. I actually believe that the reason why he launched the war against Lebanon was because he needed a war. And so he needs perpetual war, he needs perpetual conflict, I think, that's my interpretation, in order to remain in power under these extraordinary circumstances inside Israel itself.
I won't disagree with the analysis of Israeli motivations. But there are a number of things you just said, Mohammed, that I would like to comment on. The first is that the Supreme Leader is obviously very well advised or very clever to note that the Saudis and Iranians share an interest in the right to enrich uranium. And we'll see if that leads to anything. But this is, of course, the principal issue at stake in U.S. discussions with Saudi Arabia about the installation of nuclear reactors. The Saudis are in active discussions with the Chinese, South Koreans, and others on this subject. But that's an very interesting point that I hadn't really focused on. Second, the Israeli policies remind me of those described by Tacitus with respect to the Roman policy in Britain. They made a desert and called it peace. And I'm thinking of Mao Zedong's observation. The gorillas are like fish in the sea, and they hide among other fish. But the Israeli answer is to try to kill the bad fish by killing all fish and draining the sea. And that is what they have done to a great extent in Syria. And it is not a useful policy. They have always had a policy of fragmenting or balkanizing Syria. That's been their objective. And Syria is, as you say, a remarkably complicated country with tremendous diversity of religious and ethnic traditions. I can't help but conclude by noting that the absence of any checks or balances to Israeli activity have just been illustrated with their apparent drone attack on a vessel carrying aid or attempting to carry aid to Gaza, which they are starving to death. There is no food there. Prices are escalating rapidly, and we're about to see mass death. And yet, the world does nothing. So this is a terrible situation. In the end, I believe it is probably going to result in the not just the ostracism of Israel internationally, but a loss of its very existence. I don't see how it can survive on the basis of such barbaric and depraved policies. So whatever you think about the war in Gaza or the ethnic cleansing in the West Bank or the invasion of Lebanon, the seizure of bases there, the destruction of Syria and the territorial expansion beyond the Golan, Jolan, into Syria. This in the end is going to prove probably fatal to Israel.
I agree, and I also think that the damage that this has done and is doing, and I assume you agree, to the West is will be devastating for decades to come.
We've lost our moral standing, our moral authority is gone, and a great many Americans realize that. But unfortunately, they don't run the government at the moment.
I think, Professor Mann, do you want to add something before wrapping up?
No, I agree with everything that Chaz says, and I'm although these are very dark times, and the situation in Gaza is something that we all have to constantly be talking about. We should always be reminding people about what's going on, and people across the world have to be active in order to create greater awareness and to put more pressure on especially Western governments and the United States to make them pay a price for these policies. While I think we should continue that, I do believe that when we look at history, And we've talked briefly about China. We've talked about our region. These are, we've had civilizations in thousands of years. And what we see today is just a fleeting moment in history. The Israeli regime is not very old. It's quite young. And I don't believe it's going to last. I agree. It can kill tens and hundreds of thousands of Palestinians. But when it loses its legitimacy in the eyes of the global public, then it simply cannot last. On this recent trip, I went to three different cities. I went to Shanghai, Beijing, and in Beijing in particular, I spoke to different people in Shanghai as well. And the attitude towards the Israeli regime was very negative. And in Shenzhen, which was the last leg of my trip, it was, I think, even more negative. The world has changed. People before in China, most people really did not follow the issue of Palestine. Very few people were interested compared to the population. And some supported the Palestinians, some supported the Israelis. Israel was known to be a technologically advanced regime and all that. And those who didn't know much but heard, they thought it was some conflict over a piece of land by two different people. Now, the mood against Israel is very widespread. And every day that this genocide continues, the animosity and hatred becomes more entrenched. It will last. And the Israelis are simply not stopping. Every day, it just continues. And I think that they are signing their own death warrant. Now, when will that take effect? I don't know. But I don't think the regime will last more than a few more years.
You reminded me, Mohammed, of the story of when Mahatma Gandhi went to London for the first time. And he was asked, "What do you think of Western civilization?" And he replied, "I think it would be a good idea."
Yes.
Thank you so much, Ambassador and Professor Morandi, for being with us. Great pleasure, as always.
Always a pleasure.